Okay, good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming. My presentation is called Part of the Job, Workplace Violence in Massachusetts Social Service Agencies. Part of the job is a phrase that social workers and social service workers often use to talk about workplace violence. I have no conflicts. So health and safety in social work and social service settings is understudied. And one point I'd like to make is that this is a session on healthcare and social services, and while healthcare workers and social service workers have a lot of things in common, there's also a lot of differences in their work organization, the roles and tasks in the workplace, and the settings that they work in. And so I think we're missing important parts of the story about workplace violence for social workers. The way I've set up my presentation, I've realized I haven't really touched on a lot of those differences. So maybe we'll have some time to discuss, and I'll make the points as I go through. But mainly, I'd like to tell the story that our task force came up with getting this data. Okay, so this project was developed by the Massachusetts Task Force on Maximizing Social Worker Safety. This was a coalition that was convened after a social worker who many of us knew was murdered by a client during a home visit in 2008. The coalition included representatives from public and private agencies, including the commissioners under the Department of Health and Human Services, all the schools of social work in Massachusetts, the National Association of Social Workers, Massachusetts chapter, and organized labor. I need to add a caveat that the relationship with the unions and this coalition was shaky and touch and go. I think things have gotten better, but that was not always a comfortable alliance in this coalition. Since the task force convened in 2008, two other social workers have lost their lives at work in Massachusetts. So some background: workplace violence is a known and established hazard. Just for example, studies conducted since the 1990s have found rates of physical assault between 3 and 30%, verbal abuse as high as 82%. Not surprising statistics. These are all studies conducted either nationally or within particular states or regions. The rate of lost days due to workplace assault for social service workers parallels those with other care workers. In this study was interesting. They tended to stay up in a period where other days of work loss declined. So that was of interest to me. Violent incidents are frequently underreported, and there are really social service specific reasons for that, I think. And also cuts in social spending, particularly in the era of ending big government, exacerbate the social service workplace hazards. And we've been calling this double jeopardy, where the client and the worker are both at risk due to these policy changes. So we undertook this study to better understand the incidence and determinants of workplace violence in social services in Massachusetts. So in fiscal year 2009, we sent a survey out to about 200 Massachusetts private and public social service agencies. We got about 40 of those back. We conducted two agency-based focus groups, and we did some basic calculations and summarized some of the data about surveillance and the settings where incidents occurred. And here's some of the things we found. So in terms of our sample, we divided it between elder and non-elder focused agencies, and this is because some of the research has suggested that working in elder focused services for social workers is actually safer. So we wanted to at least look at that. We had about a 50-50 split in our respondents. These agencies covered about 15,000 workers serving over 380,000 clients. We looked specifically here at clinical staff and direct care staff. And for the purpose of our study, we defined this as clinical staff were those with an MSW, master's degree, or higher, direct care staff with a BSW or lower. We didn't define it in terms of job title or anything like that because we had such a diverse kinds of agencies in our study. And so this covered about over 2,600 clinical staff and over 6,300 direct care staff. We also looked at incidents involving the use of physical restraints, meaning using the body to subdue somebody else when they're becoming agitated, and incidents that did not involve restraints. And people on the committee felt like it would be important to look at the difference between those two because restraints were known to exacerbate or escalate kind of violent incidents. You can see that there were far more incidents and injuries in the non-elder-focused agencies. And although the rates look pretty similar, if you take verbal assaults out, many more of the physical assaults were happening in the non-elder-focused agencies in these 40 agencies. And I should say something about how we define workplace violence. All the studies have slightly different ways of defining and measuring workplace violence. Some include property damage and sexual harassment. We just looked at some basic categories that are pretty common to most of the studies: physical assault and verbal threat of assault. So I made these charts to make it easier to see the results, and there's a mistake on both charts, which flips the red and the blue. The most important finding we found was the consistent difference in the risk for direct care workers versus clinical staff, where the direct care folks were at risk and sometimes significantly more at risk than clinical staff. For example, in terms of the restraint-related incidents, the direct care staff were 10 times more likely to go to the ER as a result of a restraint-related incident compared to the clinical staff. They were 4 times as likely to miss work, and they were twice as likely to receive first aid for their injury. So this one is backwards, the last one there. In terms of the non-restraint-related incidents by worker types, the direct care staff, again, there's an inversion here, but they were twice as likely to be verbally threatened and nearly 5 times as likely to be physically assaulted. This was important for us as a committee. The research subcommittee of the Task Force on Maximizing Social Worker Safety wanted to make a point to the rest of the committee that even though we were social workers, we needed to be concerned about social service workers who may not have that professional designation as social workers. And I think this data really bore out that within the same agencies, some folks who are at the lower end of the hierarchy, who have more client contact, are at greater risk of these hazards. But that affects the whole agency and all the services. And so that was part of the reason why we focused so much on this division. And here's a chart that just shows you these things in a chart form as well as the confidence intervals around these findings.
Could you just define what's direct care?
Yes, so for the purpose of our study, we defined direct care in our survey by education level. BSW or below, they might be non-college educated, MSW or above. And this is basically to differentiate between the people like the aides in a group home, the people that staff a group home, from the people that provide therapeutic services, the licensed social workers, licensed clinical social workers. But we left it a bit vague because we were looking at a wide range of settings, so it would have been hard to define all the different tasks. That would have lended a lot to the data, I think. We also looked at, in these 40 agencies, what were the settings where incidents were more likely to occur, and we looked at reports of where the settings that they collected data on did occur, and we also asked the person filling out the survey to give their perception for the non-restraint-related injuries. So for the restraint-related incidents, the direct care workers, overwhelmingly these occurred in a group home or residential setting, 82%. For the restraint-related incidents involving the clinical staff, the vast majority, 68%, occurred in the psych inpatient hospital setting. For the non-restraint-related incidents among direct care workers, 35% were in the psych inpatient hospital setting, 23% in the day rehab setting, and you can see the long list. We actually asked about 14 different settings, so there I didn't include everything, but I included sort of the highest numbers here. The day rehab setting, by the way, was something that was mainly reported on by the elder-focused services, and these are day programs for the elderly. And so I didn't show it here, but if you break it down by elder, non-elder, most of the incidents were occurring in these day rehab settings. For the non-restraint-related incidents among clinical workers, the vast majority were occurring in the psych inpatient hospital setting. What's interesting is that the person who gathered this data for their agency and inputted it into the survey also reported on their perceived most dangerous setting. And you can see that it's very different than where these things actually did occur. The client home, a home visit, was perceived as far more dangerous. However, most of the incidents were actually occurring in the institutional setting. This could be partially an issue of reporting, obviously.
Who was the person that filled out the
So the person that filled out the survey was, again, left open to the agency. So there was a letter that came from our committee asking the director or CEO of an agency to designate someone to gather this data for their agency and input it. And I was going to mention this in terms of some of the strengths of the study, because there's a lot of limitations with the way we gathered our data. But one of the strengths was that people actually took the time to do this very complicated work. And we noticed, you know, it was an internet-based survey, so we noticed the time of day that people returned this, and often it was after working hours, 10 o'clock at night, things like that. So the people that did fill it out were very committed to getting this information to us and thought it was important. But so this perception was that same person who had looked at the data and inputted it, but they still had this perception that the home visit was more dangerous. So this is an important discrepancy that I think requires some attention. We also asked about how do you collect data about these incidents, and these implications were some questions that our committee had come up with, but there wasn't really a consistent way. Most people were collecting them in terms of their workers' compensation. They're really just, again, collecting things about incidents where injuries had occurred. And there were few of them had safety committees or used the OSHA log, or some of them talked about this continuous quality improvement committee as a place where they were gathering this kind of data. We asked in the survey, why do we fail to understand presenter capture data about workplace safety? And these are some of the responses that we got. Social workers tend to accept these incidents as just part of the job. More than one survey noted these exact words. Also, it's not an issue of quantity, but what happens when an incident does occur that counts, and how do we make policy to support workers? And people were concerned that that they were not capturing information that lead up to incidents or near misses or things that are not deemed reportable, but only when something serious had happened. From the focus groups, I'm just going to talk a little bit about what we found out about what they said about why people fail to report incidents. The licensed clinicians, the group that we interviewed was at an agency where most of the clinicians were female and most of the management was male, and they talked about a gendered response from management where they felt like their concerns were minimized as being just, you know, something that women would be concerned about. They were very concerned about a lack of safety planning, and while they reported a low rate of incident, they reported a higher rate of fear, and we actually had one social worker in that group really fall apart because there had been things she had not been talking about that she was afraid of in her work environment. It's the first chance she had to really focus on it, and so that made a big impact on us. We also had a focus group with a group of program managers, many who had been field workers previously, and they talked about the fact that people are sometimes hesitant to report because they blame themselves. They think they'll be seen as a bad worker. There's something else they should have known or should have been able to do to prevent the incident from happening. For these program managers, they mentioned time, obviously the time it takes to report, but this was a particular issue in this agency because they had recently changed their way of getting funded, where they were only paid for the services they provided. That was like the only thing they were able to bill for. So any time for safety training, any time even to go back and do the reporting, would be unpaid time. They also noted as supervisors that they had a strong role in helping the workforce not to minimize incidents, to raise the level of awareness and change the culture. And they also talked about how peer debriefing seemed to be something that the staff really like to utilize to really understand near misses, to get feedback from their colleagues about what you do in these kinds of incidents, and that seemed to be more valuable than reporting to human resources or even, you know, clinical supervision. So discussion and action. Limitations of our study, obviously we had a low response rate, they were self-selected participants, we had to do it anonymously, people were not willing to come forward and identify their agency when they reported this data, for reasons you can probably guess at. Our key findings were that inequality between the risk to direct staff and clinical staff in the same agencies, the misperceptions about where incidents occur, and the serious problems with underreporting. In terms of the Massachusetts Task Force, I'd just like to tell you about some of the things that they've been working on. I've since left Massachusetts, but I'm still active with this group. We just introduced legislation to support workplace safety with the Public Health Committee, and I think one of the achievements is that The union representing social workers in Massachusetts has come together with the coalition. They're now working on the same piece of legislation, which also includes the family members of the woman who was recently murdered last January, which many people might know about. There's a website where a lot of this information is available, along with best practices that some of our agency heads have implemented, really useful information for management, and a training bureau, which has been very active as well. And here are some of the names of the people who were part of the research subcommittee who developed this survey and were, you know, instrumental in collecting this data. So, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Vaughn. We have time for a couple of questions. In the green.
Yes. Could you define what you meant by restraint activity? Because in the hospital where I work, we split up the response to patients who start to act out, one between criminal behavior and patient behavior. And we have a response team that comes to restrain as a last precaution.
Right.
So it's seeing, you know, I'm seeing it as something positive, and it sounds like here this was negative, and it was highest in psychiatric care, and I'm sure they could have a response team to restrain on how to.
Right, and we don't really know anything about the particular practices and policies of each of these agencies. We just know, and I would imagine that for most of them, physical restraint would be a last resort, and there would be a lot of other techniques that would be utilized and attempted before that happened. But because we only asked them to categorize their data in terms of things that had occurred in the context of a restraint and things that had not. So I can't really answer questions about what that meant. That was self-interpreted.
One thing I was a little confused about is, you know, there's home visiting, there's group homes,
yeah,
day programs, and then inpatient settings, and it seemed like you were crossing those lines in the study, but I'm not clear that the fatalities all cross those lines. Did they happen in a certain setting?
Right, so the fatalities which prompted this, one of them happened during a home visit, one of them happened at a homeless shelter, and one of them happened in a group home.
I think those are different types of settings.
And yeah.
We've been tracking fatalities that happen during home visiting, and one of the biggest risk factors is when there's the issue of a child being removed
right.
from the home
right.
occurring at some of that time.
Yeah, and I think in a way, though the fatalities prompted the task force, this study ended up being much more about non-fatal incidents, you know, obviously. So I think there is a difference, and perhaps that perception of fear relates to the fact that when we hear about a fatality, often it is during a home visit. So